You're listening to All Things Considered on WNYC. I'm Jamie Floyd. When 30-year-old Karina Vetrano was sexually assaulted and murdered 3 years ago while she was out jogging in a Queens park, the NYPD felt intense pressure to solve the crime. As the case started to run cold, police engaged in a dragnet based on its DNA database. It led them to 20-year-old Chanel Lewis, who confessed to the crime, though Lewis later said his confession was coerced. Prosecutors tried Lewis twice, and the second time around secured a conviction. In April, he was sentenced to life in prison without parole. Now his case is back in the news. Attorneys for Lewis say the police dragnet was unconstitutionally based on race. More than 30,000 people have signed an online petition asking the Queens District Attorney's Office to investigate claims of racial bias in the case. And three of the seven candidates for Queens DA are now committing to re-examine the case if elected. Concerned New Yorkers rallied this week at the District Attorney's Office expressing outrage that runs beyond this one case. Today, in the first installment of a new series on All Things Considered that will use real cases to examine the criminal justice system, we look at DNA collection as an investigative tool. Our series is called The Docket, and our first guest is NYU Law Professor Erin Murphy. Professor, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you.
First, let's talk generally about the pressures that law enforcement can feel to solve these kinds of cases, NYPD in this case in particular, and generally in these high-profile cases. It had been a few months in the Chanel Lewis, Karina Vetrano case. They had been working on this one for some time, and it had a lot of press attention, too, and that can apply a certain pressure to find a suspect.
Absolutely. I think, you know, first, when the public is saying, hey, if you can't solve this crime, we don't have faith in you as police officers, that's going to make everyone in law enforcement feel anxious. I think when you have a victim's family that was as active and outspoken and willing to engage the press as this family, you also feel tremendous pressure just to not let the newspaper headline every day be cops still failing. And then, police are humans. So if you have a crying, grieving mother in your face every day, the need to say this is the guy is very strong. So law enforcement, I think, in situations like that, at their best, they use every tool in the toolbox. But I think at their worst, they can start to really deform and misshape the toolbox in just the hopes of solving the case any way they can.
And then let's talk about the DNA sweep that ultimately led to the arrest of Chanel Lewis. During his second trial in April, Daily News reporter Graham Raymond wrote that police investigators took DNA samples from at least 360 African-American men who had been previously in custody in parts of Queens and Brooklyn. And Raymond said only three had been arrested for violent crime.
In many cases, they had been previously arrested for misdemeanors, driving without a license, lower-level things, low-level possession of drugs. And one of them was arrested on a violation, which isn't even a crime.
We asked the NYPD about its DNA collection practices, and a spokeswoman said the department gathers DNA evidence in strict adherence with the law and follows established protocols. She also said NYPD is working with the Office of the Medical Examiner to review collection and management policies and procedures of DNA evidence. But, Professor, a few questions still arise, like, can the police conduct a broad sweep of a targeted community, and would that violate the Constitution?
I think there's a lot of problematic aspects to what they did in this case. First, intuitively, I think we all know that if some, young person was assaulted on Wall Street, police wouldn't demand DNA swabs from every white guy in Goldman Sachs because, A, those people would be outraged and say, how dare you suspect me of a violent crime? You have no authority to seek and demand my DNA. And also, this is a completely scattershot search. Just because a white person attacks someone on Wall Street doesn't mean that every white guy is now a suspect. And yet somehow that is a tolerable chain of thinking when it comes to poor men of color in a less politically connected community. There's absolutely no reason to think that any of the individual 360 people here were, in fact, the assailant of this young woman. It's just by virtue of where they live and the color of their skin that they became a suspect. And fundamentally, I think, yes, that goes against what our Constitution stands for, which is the color of your skin shouldn't determine whether you're a suspect. The police have to have much more suspicion of you than that.
So how accurate is this work they're doing?
A lot of people think that a DNA profile from a crime scene is going to be as reliable as DNA if you go to your doctor's office. But of course, your doctor's office is a sterile, controlled environment. A crime scene can be a mess, frankly. It can be DNA that's been degraded from heat, light, or other sources. It could have multiple people's DNA. You don't know how the DNA got there. So first you have this question of what's the quality of the crime scene profile? And many of these cases we see, especially ones when very little DNA is recovered, like the kind of trace DNA you would get from a cell phone or a body swab, but not an intimate swab, you might get an incomplete DNA profile back. And one of my concerns about these kinds of dragnets is that when police are stuck and they have an incomplete DNA profile, instead of having a pre-commitment to this is the profile of the perpetrator of this crime, you instead kind of have like a bunch of Scrabble letters in a bag, and then you go out and you see if you could make someone's name out of that Scrabble letter bag. You're just kind of fishing around in the community to see if anyone has a profile that could maybe be someone who could be fitted into this crime scene sample. But if it's only a few samples on a cell phone, who knows how it got there, because we come into contact with people all the time in our daily lives. It could be even someone that didn't directly have contact. So if I go to a coffee shop and I put my hand on the counter, I might pick up the DNA from the counter that was left there by a patron no longer in the store and have trace amounts of that on my hand. And we've seen cases where that has been able to be established. And I think we always have to be apprehensive about what's the quality of the DNA here, what's the quantity of DNA here, how certain are we that it was left, even in the time frame of the incident that occurred. And those are questions often that I think get lost in these situations where all that matters is find the match.
Okay. Related to that, can an individual who is not a suspect simply refuse to give a DNA sample, most commonly a swab?
Absolutely. I mean, you have a constitutional right to your genetic information absent legal authorization of police to demand it from you. So one of the dynamics I think that's particularly pernicious in these cases is that the myth that police usually operate under is this myth of consent and voluntariness, this idea that these are not coerced samples, they were voluntarily handed over. But I think there's real reasons to question how voluntary that was. It's not as though you signed a form that says, you know, I clearly know I don't have to do this. A lot of times these situations unfold instead with, you know, the knock at the door that doesn't persist, the kind of threat that, you know, well, if you don't give a DNA sample now, then maybe we're going to have to arrest you for putting your car in the wrong parking space, or, you know, maybe we'll find some other violation. So it's the sense that people have that they have to give the sample. And I think that is all too often the real dynamic in which a voluntary, so-called voluntary sample is given.
Erin Murphy is a professor at the NYU School of Law. Professor Murphy, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Happy to be here.
And we'll be bringing you future segments of The Docket with our look at the legal system on All Things Considered.